Okay, so I'll be giving a blackboard talk, except at one point I have one transparency to show you. Obviously that transparency is just to show you that we've done some calculations, so we're full of equations, but it won't be important. So now, warning, you should pay careful attention. Probably what I'm going to talk about is fatally wrong in some way, but I think it's of sufficient interest to warrant careful investigation. So I'm very well aware that I'm going down a dangerous path, because the question I want to address is a question relating to the bare cosmological constant problem. So I'll be talking about back reaction of cosmological perturbations. This is work I've started with Raul Abramo and Slava Mukhanov, and more recently, the work has been done with Ghazal Geshtisiani, who's a graduate student of mine at Brown. There's parallel work using very different methods and also different systems by Richard Woodard and Nick Salmas, and by Abramo and Woodard. So this is the outline. I'll first motivate the investigation. I'll explain our initial approach to back reaction, which was using effective energy momentum tensors, similar to work which Jim Hartle did a long time ago. Then I'll be talking about speculations and criticisms that we got based on our initial work, and then a new approach to back reaction, which I call local back reaction. So let me start with the introduction. What is back reaction in cosmology? So in cosmology, we consider the metric to be a homogeneous background metric plus some fluctuations. Space-independent background, space-dependent fluctuations. And we take matter, similarly, to be background matter plus matter fluctuations. And the background obeys the Friedmann-Robertson-Walk equations. The fluctuations obey the linear perturbation equations in the background that's given by G0 and phi 0. So now, to order epsilon square, the Einstein equations are not satisfied. In particular, even these spatially homogeneous part of the metric gets corrections which are of the order epsilon square. And the back reaction is defined to be the order epsilon corrections, order epsilon square corrections to the background. This is what I will define to be back reaction. That's a part of a more general back reaction problem which I'll be investigating. So that's the definition. So now the physical picture. We want to compare two universes, a space-time manifold which is homogeneous and isotropic, and then a space-time manifold which has some small perturbations superimposed on this manifold. So the idea is that I want to fix a time, T0, and I want to set off these two universes with the same average quantities. And then at a later time, T1, I want to measure the average quantities again, for example, the Hubble expansion rate, and you find that at a later time, the average quantities in this universe will be different than the average quantities in this universe. So particularly the Hubble expansion rate through quadratic order will be affected by the presence of fluctuation. So this is the effect that we are after. Now, so this is a physical picture. Now, our motivation to look at back reaction So the initial motivation, this is no longer my main motivation, but the initial motivation came from stochastic inflation. And the word stochastic inflation occurred many times. It was mentioned many times during the conference last week. So let me just remind you what this is. If we take a scalar field-driven inflationary model, for example, m squared phi squared, then the region of slow roll inflation is a region where, in Planck units, the scalar field is larger than 1. And there's a boundary. And at this value of phi, you get Planck density. So this is the region of inflation. 1 smaller than phi, smaller than 10 to the minus 1. That's the region of inflation. And then there's a region and in this region, it is postulated that stochastic terms will drive the scalar field up the potential many places in space. So this is the stochastic region. Now, before starting our back reaction work, we had a back of the envelope estimate, which led us to believe that back reaction effects would be important in a larger region, in a region n to the minus 1/3, smaller than 5, smaller than 1. So
1 is minus 1. 1 is,
minus 1 is Planck.
This is Planck.
This is in Planck units. And this is Planck density.
Excuse
me? N to the minus 1.
I thought this stochastic or chaotic inflation turns into a Countback reaction. Right?
Okay.
I assume each fluctuation then just grew according to the classical.
No, the stochastic equations are, it's a stochastic process where the driving terms are postulated to be order epsilon. Back reactions in order epsilon square term. It's very different. It's a cumulative effect and a secular effect. So we are exploring a different effect than an effect that is usually taken into account.
Why is it only in that regime that the what you call stochastic effects are important?
In this?
Yeah.
Okay, it's in this regime, the strength of the quantum fluctuations is larger than the strength of the classical force driving you down the potential. And it's the comparison of these two force terms that gives you this scale. And you'll see where this, well, this scale will come out of our calculation. Okay. So hopefully I've now defined what I mean by back reaction and told you why we initially started.
Robert?
Wait a second.
I just want to be sure I understand it. So when the thing that people normally describe the field fluctuates up, it changes the topological constant, or there's some different gradient way of the effective space. That will be your linear term.
That's right, that's a linear term. So if you look at the equation of motion, which
I would have already called that back reaction. But you're not calling that back reaction.
I call the epsilon squared.
Is there a simple way of saying what that quadratic term does in that example where the field just jumps up by some effective value of the topological constant delta lambda?
You'll see. We want to investigate, first of all, how do we get these terms, and then what they do. So that's the purpose of my talk to develop. What are these second-order terms? So I'd like to postpone the question. So please ask it a little bit later. Okay.
Are you going to be assuming that the first order term is small?
I'll assume that epsilon is small. But I will not assume that the phase space of modes is small. In fact,
what does it mean for epsilon? I mean, what is the sense in which the GMU is small?
Okay, so I will assume epsilon G mu nu 1 divided by G mu nu 0 to be much, much smaller than 1. I will take these fluctuations to be the usual fluctuations, the Kolbe-normalized fluctuations that give rise to microwave background anisotropies. So this quantity will be of the order 10 to the minus 5.
What I'm worried about is the way that these things build up after a few weeks falling. And that it really becomes quite different.
Right, and you see that
it would have been without the first paper.
Okay. So please keep asking that question as I go along.
Sorry, one other question just to get bearings here. Are you including order epsilon squared changes in phi or just in g?
Include in phi as well. Because we have to be consistent.
Right, good. Okay.
Okay, so we start with the Einstein equations. So now I will talk about our initial back reaction approach, which was based on constructing an effective energy momentum tensor for cosmological perturbation. So these are the Einstein equations. This is the metric and the matter which we stick into the Einstein equations. The Einstein equations are not satisfied to order epsilon square. So therefore, we would like to add terms of the order epsilon square. To the metric and to the matter, such that to order epsilon square, the Einstein equations are satisfied. And all we want is we want the homogeneous part of the Einstein equations to be satisfied. So we want the Einstein equations are satisfied at the homogeneous level for the background.
And you keep the minimum fixed. The your left hand side, you keep fixed the Einstein equations.
Well, these are the Einstein equations. This is what we stick in.
Then the Einstein equation is keep fixed in this process.
The Einstein equations are the Einstein equations, yes.
You could imagine that.
No extra terms in the action.
Okay.
We work with the same action.
But we could imagine that.
Yes. We could imagine that. We have correction terms in the action. No, we assume that there are no correction terms in the action.
So, Robert, there's always an issue in these calculations of what the slices are on which you're saying things are homogeneous.
I'll come to that explicitly. And in fact, we initially addressed it to a certain level of accuracy. Then some people were not satisfied, and they were right. And that led us to this improved work. Okay.
I'm sorry, just one other basic confusion. Delta phi is associated with the order epsilon is associated with stochastic inflation?
No. See, what I'm interested in is, let me give you a little bit of history. So the back reaction of gravitational waves was of short wavelength gravitational waves using an effective energy momentum tensor approach was considered a long time ago by Brill, Jim Hartle, and Isaacson. What I'm interested in is the back reaction of the fluctuations which are more important in inflation, namely the scalar metric fluctuations. Those components of the metric fluctuations which are associated with matter perturbation. So it's those matter perturbations. So we're interested in the scalar metric fluctuations, cosmological perturbations, density perturbations.
Maybe this is obvious and people understand. I'm just a little confused. It seems like you're trying to solve the classical equations here, right?
Yeah.
But the fluctuations you usually think of as arising from quantum effects.
Right, so we are doing a semi-classical approach. Quantum mechanics enters in giving us the initial conditions for the fluctuations. But yes, almost the entire discussion is at the Pascal level. So now, obviously, G mu 1 and delta phi are connected by the Einstein constraint equation. They are not independent. Now, how do you think? Okay. So, what I will do now is I will take these two terms, which only depend on time, and I will call this the metric, which includes the effect of back reaction. And similarly, the matter, which includes the effect of back reaction. So if you stick this ansatz into the Einstein equations, then you get Einstein equations for this metric. Which have an effective energy momentum tensor. And this effective energy momentum tensor is the spatial average of the terms quadratic in the fluctuations, both on this side and on this side. So the spatial average of chi mu nu 1 minus spatial average of chi mu nu 1. So these are quadratic. In the matter fluctuations, these are quadratics in the metric fluctuations. It's a minus sign here. This minus sign. So this is the effective energy momentum tensor of back reaction. So now I'll come to this issue of slicing. What I'm doing here is I'm taking a spatial average. And so let's consider a universe which has no inhomogeneities, nice, homogeneous, and isotropic universe. And let's choose some weird coordinates, t tilde, x tilde, to describe this universe. Well, if you just naively calculate this effective energy momentum tensor, then you find that for this nice universe without any fluctuations, you get a non-vanishing Kalmanian. But obviously, this is due to the fact that to quadratic order, you've changed what you mean by your background variables. So now the first thing that we showed is we showed that this equation, which I call back reaction equation, that this equation is covariant under linear coordinate transformation. So independent of which coordinate system you do the calculation, you will always get the same result. So the change in tau mu nu under second order gauge transformation is compensated by the change in the background. So under first order gauge transformation. So this is not invariant, but the back reaction equation is covariant. So hopefully that addresses your question, Tom.
Okay, so you say you can write this equation on any slice?
In any coordinate system. And then you do the calculation in any convenient coordinate system, and if you want the answer in another coordinate system, you can either transform the final answer, or else you can transform at the beginning, and you get the same answer. So we will therefore pick a convenient coordinate system. And the coordinate system that we will choose is a longitudinal gauge. So what I want to do now is to evaluate this effective energy momentum tensor in a simple model, scalar field model of inflation. So I take the metric to be usual Friedmann-Robertson-Walker metric with fluctuations. So phi is a metric fluctuation variable. Similarly, The mass flow is phi zero of p plus delta phi. That's the gauge that I will use.
Robert, just to be clear, your average here is only over space, it's not over the different modes. This is not the usual semi-classical general relativity where you...
I'll be considering our Fourier expand, the fluctuation. And so these expectation values that appear here will be integrals over all of the Fourier modes. I don't know, was that the, what you were?
So you are summing over all the
Yes. I'm not just taking fluctuations of a particular wavelength. But I will, so if you calculate terms that enter, this expression here will be quadratics in phi square. And if you take this phi square, this would be an integral d3k of phi k square, Fourier mode of this metric fluctuation here. And here you see, therefore, that the effect is cumulative. That reaction is cumulative. It is, so therefore, even if mode by mode, the fluctuations have small amplitude, which they have in our universe, if you have a bit large phase space of modes, you can get a big back reaction effect. So it's cumulative. And then it's also secular, in the sense that the effect does not die away. As more and more modes become are excited in the process of inflation, the effect can get bigger and bigger. So these features, this back reaction effect, is very different from the stochastic effect. In the stochastic effect, you have a little fluctuation which moves you up, then another fluctuation comes. So it's epsilon, it's order epsilon effect, and it's not cumulative. Okay. So at this point, there should be a very non-controversial step. And that non-controversial step should be just sticking this ansatz into G mu nu and T mu nu and calculating these terms. And this is the result of that I'm going to show you in this transparency. But I won't even need to put the screen down because you don't need to see all that carefully. Because you won't be interested in the exact form. There are many terms, and all terms are obviously quadratics. They are quadratics of the matter fluctuations, quadratics of the metric fluctuations, and their derivatives.
Sorry, you have two phis.
Yes. You see this? This phi, now you see, I know this is bad notation, but this is conventional notation in the cosmology literature, and I don't like introducing new notation. So this capital phi is a metric fluctuation, the generalized gravitational potential, and this delta phi, that's a matter fluctuation. And the two are related.
Phi is supposed to be lower case, and the state phi is supposed to be upper.
This curve.
No, I'm not confused between phi and delta phi.
What is script phi? What is
bar? Backslash bar.
Backslash. Okay, got it. Okay.
Classical latex.
So.
But there is usually one gauge invariant.
That's right. The two quantities are related by the Einstein constraint equation. So now what we have to do, I'll take this ugly slide away, but I'll put it back. So I won't take this down yet. You think there was a sign error? Well, the signs are very crucial, you know. So you have to...
You lost this one.
Okay.
Robert, in flat space, this quantity is also very big. It's the one in similar to this one, the one that you do here.
What do you mean in flat space?
In Minkowski space. If I estimate it typical.
Right, but then you have then you've violated the background equations. Because you cannot have, I mean, if you have a background excited matter, then you won't have flat space. Yeah, so if you just do quantum field theory on a curved background, on a fixed curved background, you calculate this quantity, so if you calculate this quantity in your quantum field theory on a fixed background, then you get a large value. That's true.
Okay.
Well, that's the renormalization issue, in a certain sense, is a cosmological constant problem. That's what we're getting at. Okay, so now, in order to proceed, we have to simplify these other equations.
The conclusion would be, for example, that the 5-4 theory in flat space is unstable. Assuming that I cannot take the cosmological constant away and that thing away. There's some obstruction to that.
Yes. Okay, so we are interested in inflationary cosmology. Let me draw a space-time sketch of inflationary cosmology. The Hubble radius. In inflationary cosmology, fixed co-moving scales are exiting the Hubble radius. And so in inflationary cosmology, the phase space of infrared moments is building up. Where infrared, I just mean wavelength bigger than the Hubble radius. Then, from the theory of cosmological fluctuations, we know that phi dot, that on scales larger than the Hubble radius, the metric fluctuations are almost constant. Then we, the Einstein constraint equation is the following. The Einstein constraint equation relates delta phi, the matter fluctuation, the metric fluctuation. This is negligible on infrared scales. So therefore, in slow roll inflation, all terms in these ugly equations which I had on the transparency, all terms which involve temporal time derivatives are small compared to terms without time derivatives. If we are interested in the infrared modes only, all terms with spatial derivatives are small. So therefore, if you look back at these ugly expressions, you'll notice that most of these terms in these ugly expressions contain derivatives. If we are interested in back reaction of infrared modes, those are not important. Only the terms without derivatives are important. So this term, and this term. And obviously that's now an important result, so now I'll have to write that one down on the board. So if we look at the back reaction effect of infrared modes, we find that this energy density associated with this effect of T mu, I call rho effective, is equal to two V double prime V square V prime square minus V times expectation value of phi square. And the P effective is minus rho effective. And in slow roll inflation, this term is negligible compared to this term. And so therefore, you conclude that the effective energy density of back reaction is negative. And the creation of state is that of a cosmological concept. This phi square, the contribution to this of the infrared modes, is increasing as a function of time because more and more modes are becoming infrared. So rho effective, its absolute value, is increasing as t increases. So these are the crucial features of the result. And then if you evaluate the magnitude of the effect, how big is this term, then you find that in this model of chaotic inflation, rho effective divided by the background rho becomes order one at the end of inflation. Before the end of inflation, it becomes of order one if the scalar field starts above the limiting value of the
Well, just a question. This term here, the first term in your rho effective, so that's something like eta over epsilon minus one. Is that epsilon being the slow roll?
Yeah, it's given by the slow roll.
So why is that always small?
It's not always small, but there's so many models in which it is small.
Okay, so.
Many models are small.
You need eta to be smaller than epsilon. So.
So now I'm finished with this part.
You're saying rho effective is negative?
Yes. And you see where that comes from physically is you have a mantle fluctuation. The mantle fluctuation itself would have infinite, would have positive energy, but it's creating a potential well. And it's on scales larger than the Hubble radius, gravity dominates over matter. And so the negativity of the gravitational energy overcomes the positivity of the mantle fluctuation energy. And that's what gives you the
increases the cosmological constant.
So now let me come to the speculations, and then almost immediately to the to some of the criticisms. So the speculations are the following. What we observe is the full metric. This is what is observed, and we don't observe the background metric. We compute the cosmological constant that's observed based on the full metric. So therefore, if we work to the order that I've been working, the cosmological constant should be the bare cosmological constant plus the contribution obtained by back reaction.
So what's the small parameter again?
It's the amplitude of the fluctuations. Delta rho over rho, that's a small parameter. That's a small parameter, and that enters here.
Well, okay, here.
It's quadratic. This term is epsilon squared.
Yeah.
And it is epsilon squared times a large phase space volume.
Okay, but what, I mean, is there a parameter you're putting in that keeps things small, or what?
No, you see, now you've come to some of the limitations. So what we are doing is, if you just have a small phase space of modes, then rho effective is very small compared to the background. But in inflationary cosmology, the phase space of infrared modes is growing as a function of time. In most of our models of scalar field driven inflation lasts a long time. So therefore, the phase space inevitably gets big. Now, obviously, once rho effective becomes of the order, the background rho perturbation theory breaks down. So there's an intrinsic limitation in our approach. So, which I'll get to immediately. So, now if you accept that what we infer as being the cosmological constant is this, and this is negative and absolute value growing, then you see that you have something that looks like the onset of a dynamical relaxation mechanism for the cosmological constant. You have something that stays constant for a long time until the infrared modes have had a time to build up, and then it starts to diverge downwards. Once it starts diverging downwards, then are the high order corrections still under control? We have no idea. Our approach does not allow us to calculate that. At this point, though, let's be optimistic for a few minutes. So what I want to argue now is that if the high order corrections remain under control and don't totally change the result, then we'll get a dynamical fixed point for the end state of land effective of t.
Okay, so the thing that's keeping the correction small is just the, what, the short time?
Yep.
So, okay. That's all.
That's right. So there's an epsilon square.
The only place you can calculate it is where it's small.
That's right.
Yes. You mean from ground?
Right.
Because it goes.
But you see, I'm putting this big question mark on the blackboard, and I intended to put it there. Even if you wouldn't have asked a question, I would have put it there. Because clearly, our approach is perturbative, and how we can calculate this is this onset.
Robert, in that sense, I think that I thought that what they do is they say, because you're thinking about perturbation in a very long wavelength, they no longer are quantum modes, but stack them all together into a classical field and treat the perturbation as if they were classical statistical perturbations.
Right, so if this is the way
you were, they do include these terms, I think.
I have never seen a mathematical derivation. If what we are doing emerges to that, then I guess I would be happy. It is usually presented as an order epsilon term.
Yes.
Yep. Okay, but so now the speculation, wild speculation. That only, and in order for our speculations to be borne out, this process needs to be under control beyond perturbation theory. So the universe is expanding, the matter energy density is decreasing very fast. That reaction is causing this term to become more and more negative until it almost overwhelms this term. Now I'm going to argue that you can never undershoot. Because what happens if you undershoot? Now, space
time, everyone.
This line is the energy density in matter or radiation, whatever dominates. So during the time that the effective cosmological constant dominates, the Hubble radius is approximately constant. But as soon as you undershoot, inflation stops. Modes re-enter the Hubble radius, the phase space of infrared modes starts to decrease, no longer increases. This term no longer decreases. So you've undershot a little bit, then it will stabilize.
So if you did undershoot, wouldn't the total energy density be negative?
I undershoot only if I...
By undershoot, you just mean rho lambda less than rho lambda.
I mean, both terms are still positive, you see. This is zero. So what's happening is that if rho in the effect of lambda becomes smaller than this, then inflation stops, and you get a matter or radiation expansion. Then this term no longer decreases. And so what you see is that you immediately get a scaling fixed point where omega in lambda effective is of the order of omega matter. Not just at one time, but for all times later than the time when this undershooting first happens. And you expect oscillations around the exact fixed point. So that's the dynamical scaling, dynamical fixed point.
So what are the constraints on the contribution that cosmological constant can make to the matter?
I can ask. So we need nucleosynthesis to happen in one of these worlds. See, one of my questions for future work would actually be to investigate how much such a scenario is actually contained. Let's not talk about that. Let's first talk about criticism, serious criticism.
At least for certain experiments, there is no perturbative solution of your mechanism, which actually confirms what you just explained, which is Stravinsky's solution of an unstable zip space.
back reaction of the matter ends the phase, which goes over in a film also.
Okay. I'm not. We should talk about that later. That's. I'm not familiar with that particular paper, I guess. It's in the context of R square inflation?
No, it's the original Stravinsky model, which uses an.
It's a
particular method theory and computes the Fett reaction.
Okay.
So it finds the solution of the same classical Einstein equations, including the back reaction of the method. And that's the solution he finds is an unstable super solution that goes over in complete mode of the work.
This lambda effective that you're finding.
Of course, Stravinsky has the same problem as you have because of all the higher order terms to become large, there's no equivalent justification for the validity of that solution. Within the limitations, you can find solutions.
This lambda effective, it won't look like lambda. Its equation of state will be like matter.
That's right. And the reason what's happening is that effective momentum is transferred between the background and the fluctuations. So it's only the total stress energy which is conserved. So you can show that the total Bianchi identities are satisfied.
So if it's true that this continues to scale like matter, you will never see it as being a cosmological constant, just like dark matter.
On average, yes. But we are now in this period.
Oh, are you sure it's really going to do this overshoot business, or won't it rather evolve continuously, smoothly?
But it starts. It definitely starts undershooting, but I don't know what the amplitude is. And the persistence, if it's damped or not.
Sorry, how did you know it starts
undershooting? Well, I really know that. Let me see. It's definitely my strong intuition. Because at the point that the tool hit, this is decreasing and this is decreasing. But at different rates. So I'm now arguing that these two curves, lambda effective P, rho mat of T, have to be continuous curves. They approach each other with different slopes. And therefore they have to undershoot. That would be my reason. But anyway, since we don't have these high-order terms of the control, obviously, it's just, I don't have a solid calculation to back up what I said.
Sorry, I was confused. Jim, you were saying that this state equation state doesn't matter?
Yeah, because of its time dependence. It's not staying constant.
See, that makes complete sense, but at the same time, you've got the original lambda and also this correction have the equation state of dark energy, right?
Yeah. So it certainly means that the energy density in this stuff is not going to cross the gravitation. Which means that it can certainly be the thing that makes up the deficit between the observed matter, which is gravitation clustered, and the flatness.
The question of the equation state is just one of time scales, right? I mean, if you're depends on what you have to average up, right?
No, what Jim is inferring is that if indeed the lambda effective of T is not oscillating, but if it's just tracking rho mat of T, then, and if you use the time dependence of that to using the homogeneous equations, Friedman-Robertson-Wolf equations, to infer an equation of state, then you would not get the equation of state.
No, but that also comes, it just becomes one of the times.
I have two questions. In order for it to oscillate, it has to be that the way you've drawn it, that the effective cosmological constant drops more rapidly than matter. But you haven't showed us what, how fast it can drop. You've just assumed that it can drop faster than matter. My second, to back up further, why is there a minus sign in the correction?
Okay, physically, the reason is that an energy fluctuation creates a potential well. The gravitational energy is negative. And on scales larger than the Hubble radius, gravity drives matter. And the gravitational energy is larger than the matter energy. And you can track it in terms of equations. It's actually the cross terms between the metric fluctuations and the matter fluctuations. It's those terms in the effective energy momentum tensor. It's those that have given rise to that. to that sign.
Usually when you have a fluctuation that gives you a negative potential, the total energy of that is actually positive.
But not here. Not here. Because it's gravity.
Yeah. Well, here's sort of a first order effect.
So what
you said is familiar first order, right?
But by the way, over
this is a one loop effect.
This is a one loop effect.
So the usual one loop effect, one gets like the V double prime term with the fluctuation of the scalar field, which is the one loop renormalization of V. Okay? Which is infinite, but one has to renormalize it. And then there is a term which comes apparently from the cosmological constant. So, but why, as phi square is infinite, why is it not absorbing the renormalization? Why don't we see it directly as a one-loop effect, and why is the one-loop effect not just renormalized away?
Okay, well, I can't. So what you're referring to is that the phi square, if you allow all wavelengths to contribute, you get infinity. What I've done is I'm introducing an ultraviolet cutoff at a fixed physical length scale, and I have an infrared cutoff, which is the Hubble radius at the beginning of inflation. And what I'm saying is that the ultraviolet term becomes dwarfed by the infrared term. And therefore, I'm calculating only the infrared term. But obviously, if I indeed take the ultraviolet cutoff to zero, then no calculations under control.
But physically, if I take the infrared cutoff to the top of the scale, then I renormalize everything because this is constant. And that's the usual physical answer for saying this effect is not real.
But this effect comes, the infrared phase space comes entirely from the difference between the initial Hubble radius, which is exponentially inflated, and the Hubble radius at late times of inflation. That's the phase space of infrared modes. We are studying the back reaction effects of those modes.
But these modes are much larger than the global horizon local.
Yes.
So you should not take them into account.
Good. So this is now one of the criticisms which we've been getting, and I was just going to turn it up.
Yeah. Something that you said about the ultraviolet cutoff, you're speaking in terms of some kind of time-dependent ultraviolet cutoff, right?
But if you force
me... You're not saying we're going to start out at the beginning and erase all modes whose physical length scale at that initial time is smaller than some cutoff.
If I do what you just said, then you find that the ultraviolet phase space is decreasing. Right.
And the infrared phase space doesn't grow because there's no place for it to come from.
Eventually it stops growing. So you get a small onset, but then at some point it would level off. Absolutely good. So let's now turn to the criticisms.
Can I ask a question? What happens when V prime goes to zero when V is a constant? Is there a natural limit there?
No, because then you don't have, then the equations for fluctuations which I've used break down. So I need to have slow roll, but not stationary scalar field. So I need V prime to go down that. But that could easily be corrected, right? It's taking different factors.
I think this is not a criticism, it's an interesting question.
No, but I mean, that's what, we didn't take the criticisms personally, we took them as a motivation for trying to improve on our analysis. So anyway, the criticisms were raised in printed form by Bill Unruh and in private to us most vigorously by Alan Goetz. I spent many hours in his office having very interesting discussions with him. So no one objected at one point where I thought there'd be objections. Because when I said that it's the total metric that determines the cosmological constant that we observe. That's not true. We don't measure the spatially average metric. We measure the local divergence of geodesics, and it's from that we infer the cosmological constant. That was one of Bill Unruh's main objections, saying that this effective energy momentum tensor approach is flawed. It correctly calculates spatial averages, but spatial averages are not what we measure. So what we should be measuring, or we should calculate, is back reaction on local observables. And Second criticism is that although we show that our back reaction formalism was invariant, was covariant under linear corner transformations, we did not show that it's invariant under second order corner transformations. So, and then there was kind of the heuristic criticism saying that how can an infrared mode affect local physics? Because it's an infrared mode, length scale larger than the Hubble radius. So these were criticisms, and so let me first of all give some heuristic arguments against this heuristic criticism. And these heuristic arguments are mostly due to Richard Woodard. So let's take a black hole and send a mass into the black hole. The mass disappears into the black hole, but we still can measure outside of the horizon the gravitational effect of the fact that the black hole has disappeared. Let's try to extend this analysis to cosmology. Let's take two mass points, which are initially are separated by less than a Hubble radius. They set up a gravitational potential between them. Inflation separates these mass points by more than a Hubble radius, but the gravitational field persists. So therefore, on a heuristic level, to us, it seems that infrared modes should be able to have a local back reaction. But we obviously need to calculate local quantities if we claim that we are making conclusions for the locally observed cosmological constant. So let me now turn to the last part, most recent part of the work. This is work mostly done by Gazal.
Can I ask you, was there an answer to the first question I asked about it dropping more rapidly than rho matter? Because I think phi squared only builds up logarithmically, so I would think that you could only end up tracking something that redshift
appears. No, it's not. It's proportional to the phase space of modes that's larger than the Hubble radius. What's growing logarithmically is the amplitude of phi on a fixed wavelength. That grows logarithmically. But the phase space of modes grows rapidly. So that's why you have this rapid decrease. Okay. I'm getting to that. That's local back reaction. So if A, let's consider an unrealistic model with a single matter field. So what do we mean by the local, what do we mean by the local Hubble expansion? Well, we take the four velocity of the fluid given by this matter, and then we can take the covariant divergence of this four velocity, and this gives us a quantity which in homogeneous cosmology is three times the Hubble expansion. This is the local divergence of geodesics, and this is the quantity that that measures the local Hubble expansion. So the idea is to calculate to quadratic order the effects of fluctuations on this quantity. That's our local back reaction calculation. So now we take the same metric that I used before. We can calculate this. This is straightforward. And what we find is we find 3 A dot over A times terms which include fluctuations, metric fluctuation again. There are terms which also depend on the derivative of phi, which, since I'm almost out of time, I won't write down. So this is the result, including metric fluctuation. So now even if you take spatial averages, this term does not vanish. So therefore, it appears that we've shown that back reaction, local back reaction is for real. Because we found that in the presence of metric fluctuations, the Hubble expansion rate is different than in the absence of metric fluctuation. However, the problem with that is that we did this calculation at a fixed background time, and the background time is not measurable. So, well, we can correct for that. We just calculate phi, calculate this expansion rate, not at fixed background time, but at fixed value of a physical clock. And in this system, where there's only one matter field, there's only one physical clock, namely the scalar field itself, or functions of that. And then it turns out that if we actually do this calculation, we find that we get exactly the same effect as in an unperturbed universe. Dependence on metric fluctuations drops out completely, and we find that in a single model with a single matter field, that back reaction, this infrared back reaction, it might mathematically be real, but it's not physically measurable, as conjectured by Booth and Unruh and others. So now, why did we get this result? So let's step back and look at the heuristic explanation of how I would like to see back reactions. So what I would say is that we are looking for a statement saying that the Hubble expansion rate in the presence of metric fluctuations is different than in the absence of metric fluctuations. But to make this statement physically meaningful, I have to say at what time. So I would say at a fixed value of the temperature of the cosmic microwave background. In order to make this system, this statement, I've had to introduce another matter field. So let's go on and introduce another matter field. That's obviously the realistic case. And introduce a spectator field chi, which represents the temperature of the cosmic microwave background. And now what we want to do is we want to express theta not as a function of background time, but as a function of the temperature of the microwave background. So this formula remains true. And now what happens? And that will be the final equation I'll write down. So if we now express theta as a function of some final value of chi, starting from with a fixed initial value of theta, the expansion rate, then so we let the temperature of the microwave background decrease by a fixed amount. Then we find that the expression for the final Hubble expansion rate at this fixed value in physical clock depends on the presence of fluctuations. So therefore, we see that the answer depends on the metric fluctuations, and that actually the fact phi not equal to zero leads to a decrease of theta. So we find that in this two-matter field model, the back reaction of infrared modes is physically measurable, and it has the effect of slowing down the expansion. But we still have not calculated the magnitude of the effect and the exact state of the effect. That remains shown. And then all of the interesting questions which go beyond the onset of instability remain fixed. So this is what I wanted to present.
Could you explain what the connection is with the work of Woodard and Unruh?
Okay. Right. So we've been working in parallel recently. Woodard is using very different methods, as opposed to these methods, which we are using quite classical generality. He's using quantum field theoretic methods.
Could you give
cosmological constant lying out.
Right. He's looking at pure dissipative space with gravitational waves. He finds that the one loop term vanishes. He gets a two loop term, which means he has a fourth order in perturbation theory. But if he uses his methods for our model of chaotic inflation, there's a paper by Abramo and Woodard, which also he has recent papers where he's started to attack the local back reaction. He and Abramo introduced a variable, very complicated variable, which measures the local expansion rate. And they found that in our model of single field chaotic inflation, there's no local back reaction. And after he did this work before we did, after seeing our paper, he told me that he's going to use our variable.
Is P equal to minus rho for the effect of these?
But so,
your interpretation is a cosmological, an effective cosmological.
Right. But so anything with an equation of state E equals minus rho is indistinguishable from a cosmological constant.
Yeah, and that's true for this?
Yep. That's. But so at any instant of time, the stress energy momentum transfer back reaction has this form.
But didn't you also conclude that as it approached the matter trajectory, it changed its equation of state to match the matter?
That's because there's that's because the stress energy tensor is not separately conserved. The stress energy tensor for perturbation. So if we wouldn't have allowed the phase space of infrared modes to grow, for a fixed volume of phase space of infrared modes, the equation said is always P equals minus one.
So you're working with a single metric, which is responding to an average of all the quantum fluctuations,
right,
which is a standard approach in sort of semi-classical relativity and things like that. And maybe I've been talking to Andre Linde too much, but he sort of convinced me that when he does inflation, it's very different, where he sort of basically imagines a metric, sort of there's a big superposition of metrics, and the metric, there's a different metric for each fluctuation because the fluctuation quickly becomes classical, affects the metric in different fluctuations, which are in the same wave function.
Right. So now I see our starting point is the same, because for each matter fluctuation, there's a fluctuating metric. Because we use the Einstein constraint equation. So we are not just looking at matter fluctuations, but metric fluctuations as well. We have background, matter, gravity background, metric, matter, perturbation. So.
But in second order, you're taking an average of all of these and feeding it back to sort of one metric.
Our idea is that we have one metric, one matter field, which is inhomogeneous, and we want to calculate that to increase the order of perturbation theory. So you see, our entire work started being not satisfied with the stochastic approach.
Wow.
We didn't know where it kind of comes out of the hat for us.
I think if you, for example, think calculating the contribution to the zero, absolute zero, could have some contributions to modes that are not absolutely zero, small k.
Right.
And they will, so you will generate on top of that new inhomogeneities that are very large. And these
that's
are the inhomogeneities under its training. It takes all these fluctuations, clumps them into one single
What you're saying is that he's taking all long wavelength fluctuations and calculating some average that at a perturbation to the metric, to the inhomogeneous component of the metric of wavelength in the radius.
Or.
But you see, we can do this calculation of this out as well. Because once we have the background under control, we could go on and look at quadratic order back reaction effects on the fluctuation variables themselves. That's what we want to do, because I think those effects could be as important, if not more important, than the second order slow roll corrections.
No, it's not quite the same. It's taking the contribution of the second order to modes that are not completely.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I'm saying.
To the background. So you change the background from being completely homogeneous anisotropic on the scales. You add an anisotropic components to the background on the scales that are.
Right, but instead of and that just means we take the mode, the delta G mu nu mode, for fixed K equals H at one particular time. And we say that this is the original delta G mu nu 1, K equals H, plus something which involves delta G mu nu 1 of K prime, delta G mu nu. They are created delta phi, delta G mu nu 1, K minus K prime.
Okay.
We could do that as well.
So I think that's the.
But I'm not sure that the calculate that this, if we do the calculation consistently this way, I'm not sure that we will get. In fact, I'm almost certain that we do not get the same answer.
Another general comment. What you're trying to do, this is related to what Bo was saying. You're trying to do renormalization in on a general background. And the result of the one loop is a function of the background fields. Now, if you could do that, that would be really great.
That's right.
But
I can't do that.
Right.
So I'm trying to understand your expression was 2v double prime v squared over v prime squared minus v. But you said that was always negative? Did I already understand?
No, not always, but for the simple models that we consider.
But for a potential a plus b phi squared, which is divergent and positive when at the origin. I mean, it's divergent and positive.
At the origin. But inflation has long stopped at the origin.
No, a plus b phi squared. A itself inflation at the origin. Constant plus quadratic. And it's slow roll everywhere. There's inflation everywhere.
V prime doesn't vanish in your model.
V prime vanishes in A plus B phi squared.
But V prime does not vanish at the origin.
Yeah,
V
prime is B2B phi. So
wait a minute.
A plus B phi squared.
A plus B phi squared. So, yeah. So V prime is 2B phi?
So it vanishes at the origin.
Yeah, but we're not at the origin. Scale of field.
What?
Because
you can be anywhere. I mean, why doesn't this expression work at the origin? Slow roll is valid at the origin. Why doesn't your expression work at the origin? Okay. What does it mean that you have this infinite positive answer?
Okay, so for this potential, what's happened is that at one point, one of these slow roll and constraint equations is not satisfied.
V prime over V is small, and V double prime over V is B.
Yeah, yeah, right. But I had to drop terms to get from my initial expression to to that expression.
So you use some relation between A double
prime on the way.
Okay.
See what potentials I have in mind is A phi squared. Simply A phi squared, and I've stuck that into neglected terms.
Okay.
So I'm sure you could take this potential.
Is there the same reason why the usual slow roll formalism breaks down when you're computing the spectrum of density perturbations of inflation? That also breaks down when B prime goes to zero.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's because then the other mode, which is the decaying mode, you have to take into account, even though usually you can ignore it.
But the
usual calculation has to have such inflation ends and the fluctuations come back inside. Whereas here,
but
it actually never ends, so I would think.
So let me come back. So this is a potential that you have in mind?
Yeah. Right.
And you want phi equals zero?
Yeah.
But phi equals zero is not slowly rolling, it's not.
Yeah, but the B double prime over B is small, and D prime.
Yeah, but the kinetic energy is good. The kinetic energy. You're oscillating about.
No, there's a big.
Oh, you mean
B
is
big.
A is
big. No roll.
Okay. Jim is absolutely right. In that limit, the usual constraint equation for fluctuations cannot be used. So I've used the standard form of the constraint equations, which are not satisfied for phi equals zero.
What do you think would happen if you tried to set zero in this potential?
In this potential, our conclusions are. We get the same sign that I was talking about.
You think it goes down, rho goes down still?
Yes, the Lambda factor goes down.
So what happens in the usual formulas for the density perturbation, instead of getting infinity, you just get an enhancement of h squared over m squared kind of enhancement when you do it correctly. So presumably, you work harder.
So this example actually even checked explicitly.
Can't you just take a other side, so to speak?
Right, you add A to the initial cosmological constant. That's right.
So his analysis applies with the replacement of the original.
That's right. Exactly.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, that's what he. That's formally what he's kind of assuming the math.
Yeah, there's something that I don't understand about, not so much about what you've been talking about, but you mentioned Woodard's work, all right? And trying to apply the kinds of ideas that you're talking about to the context that he was talking about, namely really disinterspace.
Pure disinterspace. So no math.
This whole idea that the fluctuations become classical, at least my understanding of that depends crucially on the fact that inflation ends. The freezing out of the fluctuations has to do with the fact that inflation ends and that it ends in, at different times in different places and so on. That's where the decoherence comes from. So in de Sitter space, I don't see why it's justified to think classically about the quantum fluctuations.
Right, so I have not thought in great depth about that, but one aspect, the one thing is certainly true. Squeezing of fluctuations, which is what leads you to classicalization, that happens as soon as you have fluctuations on scales larger than the Hubble radius. So if you view the Wigner function of the fluctuation state, it starts out as being a circle in phase space. It becomes an ellipse. And each point on the ellipse, as time evolves, satisfies or follows a classical trajectory. So in this sense, fluctuations are classical, even if you don't have, if you don't enter the Hubble radius. But I'm not sure that that's sufficient.
Yeah, I mean,
would you say that the Schwinger process is not real particle creation until the original uniform electric field is destroyed by back reaction? I mean, I start with a big condenser, with a bigger. I expect to have real fair creation even in the one-loop approximation.
That's the analog of the
system. That's
the
normal.
I don't feel the gravitational.
It's not an asymmetric speculation.
I don't.
No, but again, it's a squeezing process. In the electric field, the wave function of the photon gets squeezed in the same way that the in pure de Sitter space, the graviton wave function gets squeezed on scales larger than the Hubble radius. Same process.
But in this case, the question is whether the classical products or whether that will be observed any time.
Right, so I guess, in the electric field case, you always think that you have access to these particles. But if the wavelength of the state is larger than the Hubble radius, you don't really have access to the particles.
The Hubble radius stays constant forever.
But the squeezing aspect, which is crucial for the classicalization, that's already.
Well, that's part of what's crucial for the classicalization. What's really crucial is decoherence of the different contributions to the graviton wave.
But in the actual calculations, you never. But in cosmology, the calculations you do are, you always calculate things will come scale smaller than the Hubble radius. In fact, the expectation values in unit. All you need is the fact that the wave function is squeezed. You never need an artificial environment to give
it. The squeezing, as Tom says, it has to come back inside.
It has to,
it's almost pure gauge when it's outside.
Yeah, maybe.
Since Andre isn't here, we can't ask him, but I don't believe that Andre would say that what he's talking about goes on in the sitter space. I think it's important for him that he's really talking about inflation, where inflation ends and...
Right. For me, it's important to... So.
No, I agree. And everything you've told us, I was just trying to compare it to what are he's trying to do. And I just don't see the analogy.
There are certain key differences.
Because he is doing it in pure decision.
Because he's doing pure decision space. He's not talking about it.
Well, not all of his work is pure decision. Some of his work is also.
Yeah. Okay.
But
right. So the specific work I'm talking about is the pure decision work, which I really don't see the applicability.
And I'm not going to